Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
The Science of Sports podcast with Professor Ross Tucker and sports journalist Mike Finch. Coming up in this episode.
Because what we're basically talking about here is, what do you measure, how do you measure it, and what does it mean? The challenge here is to find a point where we're actually well-informed by data, but not confused or burdened or suffocated by it. Now, this is not a test you probably repeat monthly.
So the sentence read the following. It says lactate clearance is the process where lactate is created in one place and used in another. This can be in the same muscle where it is formed by type 2 fibers and then used by type 1 fibers. FT fibers have MCT4s, which export lactate, and ST fibers have MCT1s, which import lactate into the cell. Now, unless you've got a sports science degree, you probably didn't understand a single thing that I've just said, but it was a mail that I got from Ross as we built up to this podcast around the subject of FTP, and that's why we've called this podcast What the FTP. And to give you some background as to why we're doing this, and I'll give you a bit of insight. Ross and I went for a ride this morning, and obviously socially distanced ride. Ross is a lot stronger than me, so I only saw him from afar most of the ride. But over the last couple of weeks, Ross and I have been using our smart trainers for cycling. And this isn't just a discussion about cycling. It's also relevant to anybody involved in the endurance sport world. And as a result of that, and I'm kind of a bit embarrassed to say that, I haven't really understood what all these values mean around FTP. I've been the editor of Bicycling Magazine and Runner's World here in South Africa for, 20 years. And trying to understand these sort of concepts, unless you've got the equipment to kind of figure them out, you don't necessarily take as much interest as you should do. But now that I've got the smart trainer, I did my FTP test on Zwift the other day. It said that my FTP was 234, my 20-minute wattage was 247, and Ross has been showing me some stuff on an algorithm on an Excel spreadsheet that he's done, which is basically allowing me to see exactly what my 1-minute, 2-minute, 30-second, 3-minute power should be over that sort of time. So what we're going to do today is we're going to talk a little bit about some of the basics of what FTP is. It's a functional threshold power. If you don't know, most of us should know what that means. But if you do see it on your Zwift and your smart trainer and even on your power meter, you need to understand what it's about. We're going to start with the most obvious question, Ross. And I'm going to go back to when I first started training as a triathlete in the early 90s, when everything was about aerobic and anaerobic. So let's start with that discussion. What is aerobic and what is anaerobic?
Well, let me start, first of all, by apologizing for the abbreviation bombardment in that in that sentence you read. Hopefully, by the end of this, listeners will understand what those letters mean.
I doubt it.
Then the second thing is, let me congratulate you for joining the world of scientific analysis. You've said actually before on this podcast that you are a closet sports scientist, or that you wish that you'd studied it. But now, and this is the thing that I would offer also to all the listeners, because many of you are not cyclists and you don't have a necessary specific interest in cycling. What we're about to address is universal and relevant to other sports also. So running, even team sports, fitness, because what we're basically talking about here is, what do you measure? How do you measure it? And what does it mean?
Yeah.
And the whole premise is, can you make better decisions using data than you would make based on feel and no numbers at all? And obviously, there's a point at which we become blinded by data, overloaded by it, and we make worse decisions. So the challenge here is to find a point where we're actually well informed by data, but not confused or burdened or suffocated by it. So what you're doing now with your smart trainer is exactly what sports science is about in this area. It's about measuring things, asking what they mean, making decisions, relating one thing to another, FTP, LT, MLSS, all these things we'll discuss. So the first question you've asked there is the difference between aerobic and anaerobic, which is an important question, and we'll see why in a moment. Just before I answer that, this whole area is so confused by specific language that people have adopted and co-opted over years. So when we talk about what a definition for, say, an FTP or an LT is, you'll soon discover that different people often use different terms to describe what is actually the same thing, or they use the same term in one place to describe what someone else would describe with it, that same term as a different thing.
Yeah.
It's like in South Africa here, we talk about flip-flops that we wear on our feet, and in Australia they call it a thong, and in England, I don't know, they call it something else.
And a thong isn't a flip-flop. It's
right. So in Australia, they say, I've lost my thong. And you, hang on, what? That means something totally different to me. And so it's a language thing. That's really all it is. And it makes it very confusing for the end user.
Yeah.
Because people become defensive about their language. They think that it's right. They become aggressive towards others and hostile sometimes in a nasty way. Like if you spend some time on these chat forums, cycling forums and so on, you just see the way people hurl insults at each other. And actually, they're more or less saying the same thing.
About what? In other words, somebody's saying lactate threshold and somebody says FTP and they're saying, well, that's not the same thing.
I'll give you an example.
Insight into the world of sports scientist trolls.
Someone will try to be helpful. It's a guy who's a cyclist, maybe he's a coach, and he'll write an article on what FTP is, and he'll give a definition. And five people will appear in the comments and say, you're an idiot, you're a troll, you don't know what you're talking about. You said it's the power output for 60 minutes. It's actually not. It's the power output for approximately 60 minutes, which you can measure in a 40K time trial. And it's so stupid because they're actually more or less talking about the same thing with subtle variations in meaning. And in this instance, it's the use of the word approximately. Now, to a scientist who lives in a black and white world, that word is important. If you want to be absolutely precise, it matters. But oftentimes I get, it's funny, you know, like grammar Nazis who will come up in public and they'll correct your punctuation and your grammar. If you use an apostrophe when you shouldn't, or if you say your instead of your, they'll point it out. Yes, you're right, but it's not necessary. Like, I know what you meant, so let's actually just go with that, you know? Yeah. So it is a difficult area for people to navigate, and hopefully we can shed some light on that. The way to navigate the language subtleties, by the way, is to understand the principle. Because if you understand the principle, in other words, it's like holding that object up, this is what I'm talking about, then observers can say, oh, right, it's a flip-flop. Oh, right. No, hang on. Okay, I call it a thong. But we needn't disagree because we can actually both see what you're talking about. Right. So that's what we want to do here. We want to give you principles.
Okay, so back to aerobic and anaerobic.
And the reason that little monologue was important is because this is an example of such a term. And a lot of people will jump on you and say, there's no such thing as aerobic and anaerobic. We don't use those words anymore because we're grammar Nazi, sports science Nazi, and we're going to correct you on that. It's stupid because everyone would know what you mean by it. And what you mean by it is that when we exercise at certain intensities, most of our energy comes from what is the oxidative or the oxygen-using energy pathways. We're taking carbohydrates like glycogen or glucose or fats in the form of fatty acids, and we're passing them down a series of enzyme-driven chemical reactions to produce ATP for our muscles.
Which is the energy.
Which is the currency of energy for the muscle. So that's the guy that we need to get to the muscles in order to constantly power contractions.
Which stands for ATP?
Adenosine triphosphate. So it's three little phosphate molecules bound to an adenosine molecule. And when that bond breaks, so it goes from ATP, tri, to ADP, di, energy is released. And that's why it's an energy currency.
And that little sort of nuclear explosion, yes, for want of a better word, is actually what drives your muscles forward, essentially.
It's an important part of the muscle contraction process. Right. So the myosin and the actin that contract or interact with one another, they release as a consequence of ATP. So ATP is the end product of the metabolic processes. And aerobic or oxidative, is forming that ATP as a consequence of a series of reactions that ends with oxygen as an electron acceptor in the pathway. So if your body, think of your body as a car factory and as a conveyor belt, and various stages of that conveyor belt, different parts are being added or removed or changed, painted and so on, and what comes out is a car, that's what it looks like. And in the oxidative conveyor belt, oxygen is involved at the end.
Right.
In contrast, when it's anaerobic, it's...
So in other words, just to stop you there very briefly, you can create work before oxygen is involved, or not.
You can create energy before oxygen.
In other words, that would be a sprint, for instance.
You can create energy without oxygen having to be there. Okay. And that's why I was going to... So in contrast to the oxidative pathways, there are what's called the glycolytic pathways, which use glycogen to form ATP much more quickly, but with certain negative consequences, but without needing oxygen.
Right.
So that's why they're called anaerobic. So aerobic implies oxygen. Anaerobic implies no oxygen. Makes sense?
Right.
Now, those terms are outdated and they've been replaced by oxidative and glycolytic. Most people still understand what you mean by them if you said it's aerobic versus anaerobic energy supply.
Yeah.
But the reason they're outdated is, long story, but basically, like, it's not necessarily oxygen per se. It's more related to the rate at which that energy is required, which is a function of intensity. So when we exercise at high intensities, we're demanding energy supply that cannot be met by the oxidative or aerobic supplies.
Yeah.
And various things are happening. We are activating more fast twitch muscle fibers. Those fast twitch fibers are not so good at the oxidative bit, but they're very good at the glycolytic bit. So they tend to produce energy in the form of ATP without using oxygen. We'll get to this, the consequences of it in terms of lactate and acidosis and so on. When we exercise harder, our sympathetic, you know, that fight or flight nervous system is more switched on. That drives the enzymes for glycolytic, not necessarily oxidative.
Right.
We have more calcium, which also switches on enzymes. The point I'm trying to make is that there are a number of different things related to exercise intensity that shift us towards anaerobic or glycolytic as we exercise harder and harder. If we stay at low exercise intensities, marathon pace or even slower, easy training runs, easy training rides, the energy demand, the flux or the rate at which energy is produced can be met by those oxidative. And when we did our podcast earlier this year on the science of perfect training, we went into this in a little bit more detail for those listening. And one of the limiting things is how many mitochondria do you have? So going back to my admittedly bad analogy of us as a car factory, the mitochondria are the workers at each station. You know, they are the factory, if I really think about it.
Yeah.
Because they contain all the enzymes that drive this oxidative process. So an athlete who is endurance trained has more of these mitochondria, and therefore they can produce energy through oxidative routes more effectively, more energy.
So if I want to be in with the sports scientists and I'm talking to them and I'm saying things like, you wouldn't say you were going for oxidative ride. You would say I was in oxidative state and I was a glycolytic state.
Right.
That would be the current terms for what we understood as aerobic and anaerobic.
Right.
Probably in the 90s.
But again, there's a lot of hills you can choose to die on. if a sports scientist is going to choose the hill to die on to say, oh, you shouldn't have said aerobic, anaerobic, that would be, in my opinion, a waste of energy. You could say I was an aerobic ride this afternoon.
Right. Okay.
More often than not, and the whole point actually of this discussion is we use these intensities, and there's not just two of them. There's aerobic, anaerobic. If you want to divide exercise into two parts, but you could divide it into 10 parts, and then there'd be high intensity neuromuscular on the one extreme and very low intensity on the other. And so you could come up with 5 levels, 7 levels, 10 levels, whatever.
And all of those are a mixture of those two states.
Right, because
so there's no you're not in an oxidative state and just in a glycolytic state. There are mixtures of those states throughout the effort process.
There is a spectrum. It's not as though you move from one room to the next. It's one big building, and it does have poles, as it were. Like you've got entire. In fact, there's another one, the creatine phosphate system, which I'm sure you've heard of. Now, when I'm running 100 meters in an Olympic final or running from a wild animal, I'm getting most of my energy then from creatine phosphate instead of ATP. So that's actually, there's actually more than just the two we've spoken about. Mm. So yes, if you were to say to someone, this morning was an easy ride, you could say it was aerobic. You could say it was in zone two or three.
Yeah.
It, and this is again where, say, if you said it was in zone two and I was thinking in terms of a seven zone system, I would have a different understanding than if you were thinking in terms of a five-zone system. Correct. Because they'd mean slightly different things. And the whole point, really, the question for athletes listening to this is, how do we anchor it in order to plan it?
Right.
Yeah.
Okay, so now we kind of figure out what these processes mean. So let's talk about this almost mythical position, this threshold that we talk about in terms of lactate. So this is another, I guess, old school term now, because lactate threshold was always something that everybody talked, lactate turning point, all those sort of things. Just explain what that mechanism is and what those terms are now.
So it's an old term, but it's still an accurate one. So it exists. I mean, there is such a thing as a lactate threshold. Defining it is another story. Like, so it's an easy thing to say exists. It's another story to define it. We'll get to that. But if you think about, first of all, thresholds, let's take this away from what happens in our muscles and in our metabolism. If you go to the eye doctor, the optometrist, you know, they do that thing and they say, can you read the bottom line? Mm. And you say, no, it's just blurred. It looks like I'm underwater. And how about now? No, how about now? How about now? No. And eventually they change the setting. You say, now I can see it. You've hit the threshold.
Right.
And so that's a threshold for your vision. That's how they prescribe spectacles to you.
Yeah.
Same thing with hearing. Can you hear that noise? No. Can you hear that noise? Turning it up. Oh, now I hear it. So a threshold is basically a point at which something changes. So in the body, as we exercise harder and harder and harder, so I'm riding at 100 watts, 120, 40, 60, 80, 200, eventually what happens, if I'm measuring things in your body, is that I measure lactate begins to appear in your blood. That lactate was always being formed, but it was being formed at such low rates.
Is it a byproduct?
It's a byproduct of metabolism. So going back, and this is why that question you asked at the beginning is the right start point.
So even in zone one, I'm still producing some level of lactate, even though it's not measurable.
Correct. And the reason it's not measurable is because most of my energy in that low zone, it doesn't matter how we anchor it. Zone one is either the aerobic in a two-level system. It's the one out of five in a five-level system. Doesn't matter.
Yeah.
The point is it's easy intensity. Most of my energy is coming from oxidative sources, fats and carbs that I'm running through my mitochondria and so on, and it's oxygen and electron acceptor. When that happens, we form very little lactate because we don't need to. The flux is low enough that we can deal with the flow, the flux, through the oxidative systems. As I exercise ever harder, the flux goes up, and at some point, we exceed or start to approach the limits to what that pathway can deliver. Make sense?
Yes.
And then what we do is we send more of this product, pyruvate. It's a glucose gets broken into pyruvate. That pyruvate can either enter the mitochondria or it can form lactate. And when the rate is too high, more of that pyruvate is converted to lactate.
So at the risk of getting slightly technical here, I apologize to the listeners if it feels like this. When you say it's a byproduct of exercise, we talked a little bit about those little nuclear explosions in our muscles that drive the process of energy. What is the action of that? In other words, when that lactate is produced, is it, when we talk about a byproduct, we talk about a byproduct of eating is the stool we deliver afterwards.
Yeah, so actually,
is it like that? Or is
as you're talking, it's not a byproduct. It's an essential product of a specific pathway. The glycolytic pathway produces lactate as a matter of necessity.
So it's not a waste product.
No, it's definitely not a waste product. Okay. It's not like urea and uric acid that your kidneys are helping you process.
That's what I was trying to understand in my brain.
It's actually important you brought that up because I agreed too easily earlier with the byproduct. It's not. It's actually an essential end product of a glycolytic pathway that allows us to produce ATP, which we would not otherwise have been able to, and that would be catastrophic.
Right.
The problem with it is not lactate per se, but when lactate levels are going up, it's almost a flag or a marker for other things in our physiology that are changing in such a way or at such a rate, either up or down, that is going to predict the onset of fatigue. So for instance, hydrogen ion accumulation, protons that are produced also as a consequence of breaking down ATP. And so Calcium depletion, other ions that might accumulate, body temperatures going up, energy substrates are being used up at a faster and faster rate. So lactate is kind of the thing that scientists were able to measure, yeah. and then it got blamed for what they then saw next, which was fatigue.
It's because we all think lactate threshold, lactic acid.
Yeah.
It's got this negative connotation, doesn't it?
That burning feeling in my legs. Yeah. And you watch commentators, the lactic, and they call it lactic. Lactic acid and lactate, same thing, except the one has, to use a chemistry term, dissociated its proton. So it exists as an ionized form. So in other words, the human body doesn't...
So many questions to that.
Yeah. So basically an acid is a proton donor, hydrochloric acid, and it can give you its hydrogen ion.
Yeah.
Lactic acid is the same. But in the human body, it doesn't exist as lactic acid. It only exists as lactate. So again, yes. If I was a sports science grammar Nazi, I'd say, hang on, you said lactic acid, you meant lactate. And they do that. For what? I don't know. It doesn't really advance the conversation.
Yes, because I suppose lactic acid is just a sort of a general term for people. And it has got a bad rap.
Yeah.
Purely because it's that negative feeling of pain in your legs when you're putting in a big effort.
And if you said to me, lactic acid... I know what you mean.
Yeah.
What you should have said is lactate. Yeah. But anyway.
But it's important. I think what I'm trying to get across is that this lactate that we produce is something that is part of the chemical process rather than a waste product of the
and
energy.
If you couldn't produce it, as I said, your metabolism would grind to a halt and you'd actually be incapable of continuing exercise. So it's actually an enabler.
Yeah.
Forget about... So sorry, lactate, we've done you a disservice here by calling a byproduct. You're actually essential.
Right.
And then even more than that, what a scientist, very famous, one of the great sports scientists, a guy called George Brooks discovered, is that lactate is actually used as a source of fuel because, remember, you make lactate from pyruvate. But you can actually go the other way. And so now you can take that lactate and turn it back into pyruvate, and then you can use it for energy somewhere else. And that's what the body does. So the email that you began this podcast with was my my attempt at – I was actually making notes more for myself, but I was also trying to explain that the fast twitch fibers, the glycolytic ones, are making this lactate – I nearly did it – lactate, which is then released by them because they've got this transporter that can actually put it out, exporter. So it's an exporter of lactate. And then the slow twitch fibers, which we've now learned are oxidative, they are importers. So they take it back up and they use it. It's used by...
Do they use it when it's needed at a higher intensity level?
No, they use it by converting it back to pyruvate and then running it through the oxidative factory. Right.
So it's like a turbocharger.
It's basically the same as going to Europe with dollars, exchanging them, and then getting euros and then spending it in another country. Because lactate's made in one place and then it's converted in another place, and it's actually a source of energy. So it's actually called the lactate shuttle, and it's a way that you can transfer energy around the body. It's amazing. It's beautiful.
And it's adding to the other energy systems we have, like the glycolytic and the oxidative.
So in other words, now the slow twitch fibers are using glucose that they themselves had. They're using fatty acids coming from adipose tissue and themselves, and now they're getting lactate from others. Compartments also. So the same thing is happening in different tissues. So anyway, the point is that lactate is not in and of itself the bad guy.
Right.
But what it is a marker that when you see lactate, you know that the person has reached an intensity where fatigue is now going to be imminent, because along with that lactate, so many other things are changing that are challenging steady state.
Right.
So when we are exercising at steady state, we're producing and using lactate more or less at the same rate, if not exactly the same, maybe slightly more production than losses, and it's going up very slowly, stabilized. Makes sense.
It's a manageable lactate increase.
Correct.
Yeah.
And eventually not an increase, because we literally reach steady state, which leads us to another one of
So is that the definition of steady state? Strictly speaking.
Yes, in this context. And so there is literally a definition, MLSS, maximal lactate steady state. What is the power output that you can cycle at for a period of 30 minutes, let's say, without your lactate going up?
Is this sweet spot training? Can I throw that in there? And it, I know it depends. We should talk about it later, but it kind of feels like I can ask that question now.
Yeah, it is. Again, it would depend a little bit on which coach and which person you're listening to in terms of their language, their paradigms. But it's one of the sweet spots. I mean, one person's sweet spot might be too easy or too hard for another, but it's one of those because it's the point at which we're able to, in theory, exercise for a long time without premature fatigue.
Right.
And where we're challenging that balance, you know, because we're at that point where the lines at the bottom of the screen at the optometrist are blurred, and now they're clear. Then they're blurred, then they're clear.
Get it?
We're exactly there. So in that sense, yes, it is. And so maximum lactate steady state is a measurable marker. You can look up on PubMed or Google Scholar, whatever, and you'll find studies that have used MLSS as a predictor of performance, as a predictor of lactate threshold, which is a slightly different thing, as a predictor of FTP and all these other concepts. So it turns out it's actually a very important physiological, biochemical, metabolic metric.
Yeah.
And it has performance implications. And when you train, what you are doing is you are changing that power output. So MLSS is a power output. It's 250 watts because that's the power that you could ride at without lactate going up.
Right.
If I made you at 260, it's going up.
Right.
240, no problem. 250, you're at threshold. So that particular threshold, let me be clear on that.
Yes.
And what happens when we get fitter, and we spoke about, remember our fictional friend John who was going to run a marathon, so this is running or cycling, is that the intensity at which that lactate accumulation begins to occur ever faster is shifted up. So now instead of it being 250, 10 weeks later, it's 260. Right. 20 weeks after that, it's 270. So why? Because our mitochondria number is going up. Our capillary numbers are going up. Our glycolytic, our capacity to use lactate is going up. So all of a sudden, all these things that used to produce it and allow it to accumulate are shifted. We've raised the ceiling, and now all of a sudden we produce less lactate at a given power. We use more lactate at a given power. Therefore, our steady state goes up. Makes sense?
So training shifts lactate usage.
Yes.
Yeah.
Exactly. Because
so that's one of the functions.
Because we don't need, as our muscles get stronger, we don't need the fast twitch fibers. We don't have the same sympathetic drive. We've got more mitochondria to take up the pyruvate into the oxidative pathways.
Right.
And therefore, we are producing less of that lactate because it's just not needed as much as
it
was.
So it's a marker of fitness, isn't it? From a scientific point of view.
Training status, and because of that, it becomes a predictor of performance. And it's actually a very important one. When you look at, in this context of the sub-2-hour attempt, papers came out, and they always say this. It's the same for cycling and running, by the way. Three things integrated to predict performance is VO2 max, like the size of the engine, the economy, that's fuel utilization, how much energy can you produce for a low oxygen cost, and the threshold, which is either lactate threshold or MLSS and so on. And that's where, again, like not wishing to muddy the waters, hopefully we've made the waters clearer here. So I hope that what I'm about to say doesn't muddy them for you. But when we talk about lactate threshold, there are so many ways to even measure it. You know, like you'd think, it's the point at which lactate accumulates. But mathematically, does it accumulate when it goes up by 1? Does it accumulate when it hits a level of 4? Does it accumulate when it goes up exponentially? Is there a turn point? So when you read papers on this stuff, they actually have to explain how did they identify the lactate threshold.
And it's not something you and I could do on an average Wednesday morning ride anyway.
No, like so for example, there's one method called the DMAX where you basically have to, I mean, it's not unnecessarily complex. It's necessarily complex. So you have to do it like this. But it's crazy to think that you could tell someone, there's a lactate threshold. Cool, just measure it. Well, no, because if I use this method, the DMAX, maybe I get a slightly different point, power output, compared to if I use the 1 millimolar threshold or the OBLA, as it's called. You might have seen this in magazines, those of you who read up on this. And so when you see studies then that say, lactate threshold fails to predict FTP or lactate threshold is strongly associated with FTP, like how can these papers have different outcomes? They've done the same thing. Well, subtle differences make subtle differences. And that's one of the reasons.
So give us an example of how you can measure it in a lab, but what do they do?
Well,
do
so
they initially take a blood sample and measure the number of lactate while that person is in exercise mode?
Yeah, so if you want to do a lactate threshold, remember what you're doing here, imagine this for yourselves, listeners, is you've got a graph, y-axis, x-axis. The y-axis is lactate concentration.
The x-axis is the one that goes up.
The y is the one that goes up.
The one that goes up and the x-axis. Yeah.
X-axis.
I'm just seeing my brain what you're saying.
Left to right, so the vertical margin is your y-axis and horizontal is x. And so y-axis has your lactate concentration and your x-axis is time, or in this case, intensity. And it's going 100, 120, 140, 160 watts. Mm-hmm. And what we would do is we would make you exercise at ever increasing. Every 3 minutes, we add 20 watts, whatever. There's various protocols. And initially, the rate of lactate increase is very low. It almost looks like a flat line because, as we've now discovered, we're producing it and consuming it, or clearing it, to use the technical term, at the same rate.
How are you measuring it? How are you seeing that lactate?
You just take a blood sample and then you just do a lactate assay and it works out the concentration because it looks for the actual
in other words, as the person is doing the exercise, you're taking the blood sample?
Every 2 minutes, 55 seconds, because you want it right at the end of each workload.
How do you do that?
you don't stick a needle in the guy every 2 minutes, 55. Generally, what you do is you run a cannula, which is a little thin, flexible plastic tube, and that sits in the vein. It's taped on there. It's the same as when you get an IV in the hospital. They just make and then they leave it there, right?
Right.
So, yeah, it's not the worst thing in the world, but it's also, for some people, it is.
Yes, but they're basically, yeah, so you can literally go in there and draw every single time there's a movement. So,
yeah, and these days, like, and you'll see this in field testing, is you do a finger prick or an earlobe prick, and that's like when you have your cholesterol and your glucose measured at the pharmacy, those of you who've done that, and then you get these little portable lactate analyzers. And sometimes there are question marks over whether those things are valid and accurate, but right. I think these days they're not bad. Yeah. So there's different ways to do it. But in the lab, that's how I would have done it. We run a little cannula and then measure every 2 minutes, 45 seconds, we just get a little tube full of blood and we put that on ice and we test it later on.
So now it's flatlining early on.
Right,
and then
so we're building this graph and it's flat early because your clearance and your production are both, they're matched, you're in steady state. And then all of a sudden, it starts to tilt up. And at the risk of using an analogy that we're fed up with, is if you ever see the graph of COVID-19 cases over time, it tilts up. It looks really easy, flat in the beginning, and all of a sudden it just takes off. And it looks like it's called an exponential graph.
Yeah.
And that's what lactate looks like over time in those tests. And now in theory, the point at which it tilts up is your lactate threshold, or corresponds to your lactate threshold. But as I've said, measuring that's actually quite difficult because it's a mathematical, and there's various, like the Dmax, you basically take the lowest and the highest, you join them, then you run a line parallel to that that's a tangent, and you work,
But any time on that curve is a threshold of some sort, but I suppose the difficulty is where on that curve do you make that line?
Exactly. Especially when it's a smooth curve, then how do you say, because you would have heard maybe the word lactate turn point.
It's not a corner, it's a
curve.
Yeah.
So that lactate turn point is a little misleading because it's not as though it sort of goes and then all of a sudden it gets to like a T-junction and changes direction up. It actually sometimes is quite smooth. And I've even read papers where they'll say, we tested 15 people and in 3 of them we couldn't determine the threshold because there were too many confounding or too many other, you find 2 or 3 different thresholds in the
same
person.
Is it not possible that it goes up so fast that there is a corner that you can't detect?
Sometimes. I mean, sometimes you do. You get different shapes of it is what we're trying to get at. When you do an MLSS, maximal lactate steady state, what you do is usually you do a lactate threshold one before, and then let's say the guy, you're estimating it's 260 watts. You get him in at 260 and he cycles for 30 minutes at that. If his lactate goes up, you get him in a few days later and you make him go 250.
Right.
Or if it doesn't go up, you make him go 270. And you basically, through trial and error, it's not different, those who lift weights, to how do you figure out a 1 rep max?
Yeah.
You sort of estimate, and if he can handle it, you add. If he can't handle it, you go down, and eventually you find it through trial and error. So there's different ways to do it.
So you can find the apex of that corner if you did the laborious bunch of tests.
Yeah, so you need, and I mean the studies I was looking at in preparation here, there's a handful of them, and you need people to come in four times because they've got to do the initial lactate test, and that doesn't even include a familiarization in some cases that you might need just to get them accustomed to what's going to happen. So the point is actually, and it's a good segue into this, is that's not really accessible to people. I mean, how many people have the inclination, the time, the money to go and do that? It's invasive and it's time-consuming, potentially expensive. So then what we get instead is the functional way to assess threshold, and that is where FTP comes in. So you've called it what, the FTP, and I hope you're going to spell what as W-A-T-T because that would be appropriate.
Okay, I'll do that.
So now you get an FTP, which is basically the practical, functional, that's the clue, functional threshold.
I was
going to
say, can you explain functional for me? Because you're saying it's now functional. What do you mean by functional?
Well, because it's not entirely true, I suppose, to talk about a lactate threshold and all that sort of stuff as theoretical, because it's still real. Yeah. It's just laboratory derived. Functional is meant to infer accessible to anyone on your smart trainer, or if you've got a power meter on your bicycle and a flat road, you can actually now go and measure this thing in a functional way, doing the thing you do.
Usable.
Yeah, accessible, usable, pragmatic.
Right.
But it's the same thing conceptually. It's a threshold power. And so FTP would be defined as the power output that a person can sustain in a semi-steady state mode or a quasi-steady state. In other words, they're right on that threshold where if they went harder, they would start to accumulate physiological changes that would cause fatigue.
In other words, the lactate overload.
Yes, although again, remember, it's not the lactate per se that's causing the overload. It's the lactate that's a marker. So it's the intensity overload that we can identify through lactate measurements. Okay. Make sense?
Right.
So and that's exactly what it is with FTP.
It's a subtle difference, but I get what you're saying.
But yes, it is a subtle difference. But it's like if you're walking through a field of landmines and there are little red flags, the flag's not going to be the thing that blows you up.
Right.
But if you see the flag, you don't go there. It's a small thing, but it's the thing, right?
So we're going to do a podcast on your analogies of 2020.
I promise you, sometimes I listen back to these podcasts and I think, oh, what was I thinking?
I'll make a highlights package for us sometime later in the year.
10 other things to use and I didn't. But anyways. That's the joy. We don't. It's not live.
As long as it explains, and I think we all understand what those things mean, so it helps to explain it.
These are not live, but they're live. You know, just so you know, folks, we don't edit this and make sure we get it exactly right. We just sometimes we fudge our way through the mud here. So what I was saying is, you can then define FTP as the highest power output that someone would be able to sustain for a prolonged period in a semi-steady state mode. And now, prolonged period, define that, right? This is where things get nuanced and this is where people get hostile and the arguments begin.
Right.
Depending who you listen
You're
to.
You're answering my questions already.
And Andrew Coggan is regarded as, I guess, the father of the FTP concept. And he talks about a 40-kilometer time trial. Now, for some people, that's 50 minutes. For some people, that's 75 minutes. But that's how he would do it. You can do it as a 60-minute effort. So in other words,
why would a 40-kilometer time trial be a measure? Because that's different for everybody.
Because most people can ride for approximately an hour at that semi-steady state intensity.
Right.
And so it becomes a 60. But this is where, for instance, I told you in the beginning, like someone will say it's your 60-minute power, and then someone will say, no, it's approximately your 60-minute power. So and then you start wondering, well, why are you quibbling about a word? But
So is the ultimate practical test of the FTP then, I'm just throwing this out there, is the 1 hour cycling record.
It's become that way. It's rejected by some. They say, no, rather just do a 40K. But for me, like just do it as a 60 and then call it your FTP as assessed in a 60-minute effort.
Right.
You know, it would probably be, in general, accurate. It would be the same thing as your 40K. And it's more or less the same as your MLSS, maybe a little bit higher in a well-trained athlete who can ride slightly harder for 60 minutes. If they're well-trained and well-motivated, their FTP tends to be a little bit higher than their lactate thresholds and their MLSSs and so on.
So here's a good question. The top riders that we see around the world and over the years that have attempted the one-hour record on the track, Jens Voigt of this world and the many sort of big champions around the world. When we talk about that 60 minute, they're doing the 1 hour. Do they scientifically now say when they go into those 1 hours, what is they must ride at the FTP? Would that be their measure of effort
a little higher than that. They probably, because remember their lactate clearance and tolerance, and it's particularly tolerance is so high because of the level of conditioning that they can actually ride slightly above that for an hour, right, and just accept that. So they would ride at a greater percentage of lactate threshold or maximum thresholds than most would do.
But it would so maybe be a baseline, bit. I suppose. They would know that was their baseline.
And there's no doubt that this concept, these concepts have evolved. And there's a 20-minute FTP as well, which is not strictly speaking FTP. These things evolved in order to support those kinds of performances.
Right.
So the short answer is yes. The degree to which they would monitor and measure that and potentially dictate their performance outputs might vary depending on the person, but it would be the best predictor of their ultimate performance is their power at FTP, because that's kind of what they're about to do. You know, the fact that they're covering 56K or more in that hour is neither here nor there.
But if I was going to go out and do the 1 hour Zwift FTP test, I would be going as hard as I potentially could do based on rate of perceived exertion, all sorts of other factors.
Right,
that would give me a more accurate. Supposedly more accurate reflection of my 1 hour power if I did 1 hour.
It would be exactly your 1 hour power.
Notwithstanding my mental fatigue.
Well, and this is the problem. So now this is where you start to get variations in how you can assess this thing. So those of you who've done your FTPs like Mike has done, like you've done recently, right, is you don't do a 1 hour trial because a 1 hour trial assumes such a level of motivation, pacing ability, because most people don't really do that. I mean, it's so long to sustain what overall is a max effort. I mean, it's not a max effort because if it was, you'd be poked in 2 minutes.
Right.
So it's a sub-max max, which is a tricky concept for many people. The idea is that at 60 minutes and 2 seconds, you should fall off the bike.
Right. But you don't, because you're pacing. Your governor brain goes, hang on a minute, I don't want to do that.
Exactly. You see, you're becoming a scientist.
A pseudo-scientist.
So that's why you get the 20-minute test, right? So now you've got this test that's been developed where you do a very structured warm-up. It includes a 5-minute all-out effort, then a 10-minute recovery. Then you do the 20-minute test, and you take that power output and you knock 5% off of it, multiplied by 0.95. Some say 0.93, some say 0.95. My opinion on that, and it's the same thing as is it a 60, is it a 65, a 55, is it doesn't really matter, because what you're going to end up doing is using that outcome, that power output, whether it's a 20 minute or a 95% off 20 minute or a 60 minute, you're using it as an anchor point to then adjust training in future. So as long as you understand what you've measured and how it impacts on training decisions that you make, it probably doesn't really matter if it's off by 5 watts or 10 watts, because let's be honest, like on a good day versus a bad day, there's naturally a 10 to 20 watt difference between what you feel like, right?
Yeah.
So why would you then lose sleep over, is the accuracy of my test to plus and minus 2 watts? The point is it's trivial by comparison to the day-to-day noise that we encounter in life as in physiology.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
So let's go into how we use this FTP number. So for those of you that have done your FTP test, whether it's on Zwift or any of the other smart platforms, whether you've had the opportunity to do one in a gym or even do one on your bike out on the ride or run it or whatever it is, we talk about these numbers and we say that we've given you a lot of the theory behind them. So now this is the crux of the question that we talked a bit about this before we did the podcast. How do we use this number? when we are training for an endurance event? In other words, how is it useful to us?
Well, it's a couple of things. One is that you can use it to track your improvements. So, and if you're going to do that, by the way, then FTP might be one of a handful of different metrics that do the same thing conceptually, because your ability on a bicycle or as a runner, because this, by the way, and if you've stuck with us as a non-cyclist, well done, but I can't make the point strongly enough. This is the same stuff that a runner has to deal with, except they deal with velocities, not powers, and they deal with aerobic and anaerobic capacities and speed at threshold and all this. You know, a marathon runner's performance is predicted by the same things as a cyclist, except it's speed, not power.
I guess so, it's the same for triathletes or anybody in endurance sport.
Really. Swimming will be similar, though I know so little about that I tend to steer clear of those shallow waters in that respect. So the first thing is you can use it as a test, because as we've said, as your condition improves, your physiology changes in a direction that favors a shift of that threshold power right.
Right.
So what was yours? 247 for 20 minutes.
Yeah.
Given that you're now doing a lot of riding, by the middle of August, 6 weeks from now, you would want that to be 260, if not more, 270, right? Which means that your FTP over 60, the estimated FTP, strictly speaking, will be up also by, I don't know, 10, 15% if you're doing it well.
Yeah.
So if you do the tests regularly, then in effect, you are assessing whether there is progress, yes or no.
And according to, just to clarify how these tests work, the 20-minute test then says if you've got an average wattage of X amount for your 20 minutes, the percentage of that test, I think it's, what is it, 98% of your 20-minute test is your theoretical FTP?
95 is the conventional one. So I think that's what Zwift does, and Strava might do the same. Coggan's written 93% in one of his books on the subject. But it's, and that's where I got to the point of, like, the difference between 93 and 95% is a handful of watts, and it's not really worth losing sleep over those. Yeah.
But that's how those tests work, essentially. They allow you to create a theoretical FTP for a shorter test.
Without having to do the 60-minute effort. And you could do a couple others. Like, you could do an interval training session where you do long intervals, like 2 by 20 minutes, you know. And whatever you do as an average for those 2 20-minute intervals is probably close to what you do in a highly motivated race reward situation for 60. You can also, if you do enough riding, and those of you on Zwift and Strava, you'll see this. There's a critical power curve that those programs produce for you, where they will take your best efforts over 5, 10, 20 minutes. And if you've done 6 months and you've spread your effort out and you've gone hard for a couple of times for 20 minutes, that's not going to be far off either.
Right.
And then there's another one you can use, which is the critical power concept. And again, I hope we're swimming through clear waters here. Critical power.
I'll stop you if we're not, don't worry.
Yeah, we can make it even simpler. Critical power is very similar to FTP as a concept. It's defined as the power output that you could sustain without fatigue for a long time. Okay, vague. It turns out that It turns out that the critical power, the way that it's measured, deduced, or calculated and defined, is the power output at which most of your energy is aerobically produced. So again, we come back to your initial question. So it's an oxidative limited power output. So let's say that yours was 250. If you were to go 260, you would be non-oxidative for a small portion of what's required. And as we've discovered, when we go into those non-oxidative, those glycolytic sources, we start to get early fatigue.
Right.
So does this sound a lot like the FTP concept to you? It's the same thing, right? It's a power output that you can sustain for a long time because it's in that steady state, right on the limit of where your physiology would start to cause fatigue for you.
Right.
And that's what critical power is. And the way you measure, because critical power leads to, I think, one of the most interesting concepts, which is the anaerobic work capacity, or the W prime, as it's called. The way that works is, you basically, again, you draw your graph, y-axis, x-axis. Your y-axis this time, the vertical line, has got your power output, and your x-axis has got duration. 3 minutes, 5 minutes, 10 minutes, 20 minutes, 30 minutes, 45 minutes. Take your pick of, or take all five. And you would plot your best performance for each of those durations. And what you would get is what looks like half of a skateboarding ramp. It's like it drops real steeply initially and then it becomes flat at the bottom.
Yeah.
So it's kind of like half of a U.
Yeah.
That is called a power duration curve. And what it shows is that your power for short durations is very good. This is your best ever 3 minutes, 400 watts. Your best ever 5 minutes is 360. Your best ever 10 minutes is 300. And your best ever 20 is 265, whatever, okay?
Right.
And that curve, because it will be a curve, can then be used, you've got to tinker with it mathematically a little bit, to work out critical power, which strictly is where that curve is going to become a flat line. It's called the asymptote in mathematical terms. And it can be used to determine something called the W prime, which is, as I said, your anaerobic capacity. So that you can think about as the size of your battery. Now, if your critical power is calculated appropriately, it will be very similar to your FTP.
Right.
Like we're talking handful of watts different, right? Which is nothing. Over 260 watts, it's trivial. Because they're basically speaking about a very similar thing, right?
Yeah.
But, and what it means is that at 250 watts, you are in a semi-state, mostly aerobic state, where your energy is coming from those oxidative pathways and you can keep going, not indefinitely, although that's one of the flaws in the critical powers. It does say indefinitely. It's clearly not the case. No. You can't dry it forever.
Because other things fatigue anyway.
Yeah, you're just going to get fatigued muscles, neuromuscular system, thermal system, energy substrates, etc. All these things.
It's a theoretical
prediction. 250. If I'm at 260, I'm using energy beyond my oxidative capacity.
Right.
At a rate of 10 joules per second. Now, those 10 joules per second are eating into my battery. Right. So if my battery had a capacity of 20 kilojoules, 20,000 joules, every second I'm using 20 of those joules and my battery is getting smaller and smaller and more and more and more depleted. Eventually that battery is going to run out and that's the point at which I will fail. And so the concept of this W prime is that if you know W prime and you know critical power, you can predict fairly accurately where the person is going to fatigue. And that's,
so W prime is defined then as the amount of joules you use during a set level of activity or time of activity.
It's kind of like the strict definition, it's the slope of the line of power against time, the inverse of time. And
right. What
it basically means, or it is the intercept if you plot power as a function of the total work done in a given bout of exercise. Mm. And so what it basically is telling you is your anaerobic work capacity. How much work can you do beyond or above critical power?
Right.
And it's a very interesting concept because for every second that we are above our critical power, we're using that battery. And for every second we're below our critical power, we replenish that battery. So when we do variable paced exercise, like a cycling race, and we hit a short, sharp 1 kilometer climb, and everyone just goes for it, and the power goes from 200 to 450 watts, everybody is above critical power for 3 minutes, 10 seconds.
Mm.
Unless your W prime is large enough, you're getting dropped on that climb.
Right.
Now you get to a 6 kilometer climb, like a Cat 2, everyone's going 350. If your critical power is below that, you're eating into your battery.
Right.
Is your battery big enough to get you to the top at 5 watts a kilo? Maybe, maybe not. So it starts to become actually quite a useful way to predict performance because it predicts fatigue. It's a really cool concept.
And you can then predict things like your interval sets and your, based on the, if I can push out my 500 watts for a 30 second interval, I know that I can do that based on that critical power number.
Exactly, because again, you're using that anaerobic battery
right
when you are above critical power and you replenish it when you're below.
Right.
Now, it's not one-to-one. You don't use it at the same rate that you replenish it because eventually it's progressively getting smaller and smaller. But it starts to become quite a useful tool. As long as you understand its limitations, it doesn't work well at the extremes. So anything less than about If you're a high-intensity athlete, probably 2 minutes. If you're more of a roadie distance guy, 3-5 minutes.
Right.
And anything beyond an hour starts to also become a little bit ridiculous. It makes some false calculations and predictions. But anything within that actually becomes quite useful. And there's no doubt that that is one of the key things that is used by elite athletes, cyclists and runners. Remember when they did the sub-2-hour marathon attempt gimmick the first time in Monza? You saw Kipchoge, Tedesi, and... Who was the third guy? Lelessa, the Ethiopian. And they hit halfway by definition in 59:50 because they were running 2 hours. And sure enough, both those guys were gone. They were dropped. So Kipchoge is able to run at 21 kilometers an hour without any problems, whereas the other two guys are cracked. And then you look at that and you say, well, how is that possible? They run 204, 205 marathons and they can't stay with him till halfway. It's because he's at threshold or below and they're just over. And so they're eating into that battery and he's not. And so it has profound effects on performance, even though it's actually a small difference, because you imagine that curve's exponential. The moment you start heading up, you head up quickly.
Yeah.
And so it becomes actually really interesting and important as a way to gauge and assess how much better is one athlete than the other. They're actually 2% better, but they can run twice the distance at the same speed. It's crazy.
So we were talking before the podcast about how, you know, many of the riders, Tour de France and elite riders, the pro riders that we see out there, when a guy accelerates, so if a guy like Chris Froome, for instance, going up Mont Ventoux and he's driving along at, you know, 6 watts per kilo, and then suddenly somebody goes off the front, he knows theoretically and scientifically that that person that's gone off the front is going to blow up because there's no way they can maintain a watts per kilogram that's out of the norm. Although in cycling, who knows what that norm is? But there is that scientific. And you told a great story to me before the podcast about I think it was Lance Armstrong talking about Pantani at one stage, which was an example of how science got involved in a race.
And I mean, who knows with Armstrong as to whether this is embellished after the fact? You know, Armstrong's that guy who catches a fish, and three tellings later, it's a great white shark. So I don't know for sure, but the story was that Pantani attacked him and it opened up a gap, and they were very concerned about whether they needed to really go for it and chase him, because he was out front in the race and he was absolutely destroying everyone. And apparently Armstrong got Michele Ferrari, who was his coach, on the phone, and they said, listen, you're watching this, do you think he can keep this up? And Ferrari came back and said, no way. And one of the ways that you would estimate that, you don't know it, you're placing a bet,
right,
is you're looking at the guy and saying, given his physiology, we know that he can do 6.2 watts for 20 minutes per kilogram, right? He's just attacked, and based on how quickly he left you, he must be doing 6.8.
Right.
In order for him to sustain that effort, given his FTP of 5.8 watts a kilo, he would need a anaerobic work capacity of X kilojoules, and it's just not feasible that he's got that. And so therefore, I think he's going to blow. And I'm pretty sure. I mean, I don't know that they do it as logically as that, where every item is questioned and assessed. But these guys that ride to power and they're just looking at their watts, and an attack goes off. Okay, he's just gone off at 520 watts. I'm going to go from 400 to 420. Because he doesn't have it in him to do that for another minute, another 5 minutes. And so therefore, at 420, I'll get him again in a K. And they become quite systematic about it. And again, I wouldn't...
And it's amazing how accurate that does work. We've seen Froome do that a couple of years ago. That was one of his tactics, frustratingly, for us cycling fans, to watch that sort of looking down on his power. It's almost become a sort of a meme in cycling.
Yeah, it's hell of a doll. You're just riding, looking at the stem. You might as well be on an indoor bike and looking down and watching Netflix on your bicycle. And I'm not sitting here saying that that's how they're working it out. They're making guesses on critical power. Because again, if you get it wrong and the guy's critical power is 10 watts more than you guessed, or his W prime is 10% higher than you guessed, he's never coming back.
Right.
So you'd be pretty stupid to place all your bets on data. But they are certainly based on a combination of experience and knowing their own limitations and what are basically at that level human limitations. That's where again in cycling, doping and who knows, motors and stuff starts changing human limitations, and then it gets laughable. This is the concept is the same thing, is that it's just not tenable to attack. And this is what you've heard, actually. Other teams are told, back in the postal days and now back in the Sky days, why don't you attack, Nairo? He says, how do you attack at 420 watts? We're all riding at CP. We're all riding at critical power for 25 minutes. You want me to attack? You know what's going to happen if I attack? Well, for that power, I'm gone.
Yeah.
I'll drop out of the top 20.
Right.
Yeah. So physiology is winning the day, you know, and that's where these trains that just go uphill at 406 watts a kilo for 20 minutes are neutralizing physiology. Yeah.
Just as an aside, I must say, I know there's a big school of thought around this in cycling, but, you know, I hope that at some stage when we look at cycling, they'll ban power meters
and radios,
and it will change the sport of cycling for the better.
Well, I mean, just think running. Remember, one of the most famous or most enjoyable marathons in recent times was that race that, two Boston marathons, the one that Meb won and the one that the Japanese fella Kawuchi won in the freezing cold. Because, the guy goes off the front. And there's no feedback. The runners have to make a decision. They make the wrong decision. They let him go.
Yeah.
Next thing, he's got 3 minutes. Now there's a 5K left, and it's everyone's pinning their ears back to catch him, and they can't.
Yeah.
And it's exhilarating and exciting, and I agree with you. Like, it's just so micromanaged.
I know. It's disappointing.
Yeah,
agreed. So let's kind of wrap it up a bit, and we've gone through the science. I hope that we've kind of explained a bit more about some of the sort of physiological and scientific process. I've certainly got a lot of clarity about this process for myself now. I'm still going to be a sofa scientist, but it helps me understand why we have this number called FTP. I guess in a way, when I think about FTP and having had this discussion, it feels like a democratic way for people to understand effort. So in other words, when we understand this number, it gives us a line to understand where we are. When it goes up, we have improved. And for me, I guess practically, and I think we were talking about this before the podcast, I kept on asking you, how can I use this when I'm going up that 6-minute climb?
I don't think I've answered that. So maybe you're going to ask again.
Can you answer that question?
I can try, because you asked before and I said, well, one thing you do is you repeat the test.
Right.
Because the test outcome is an indication of your progress and your adaptation. So this is not a test you probably repeat monthly. It's probably a test you repeat quarterly, so every 2 to 3 months. If you're new to cycling, by the way, your FTP is going to change quicker because you're on you're on a steep part of the learning curve, the adaptation curve. So then you might measure your FTP once every 6 weeks, maybe every month even, as you get better. Whereas if you are an experienced cyclist, your FTP is not moving that much if you've been riding for a long time. So now you do it 3 months, maybe even 6 months. Maybe you do it if you're competitive, pre-season, mid-season, and that's it. So anyway, point is, it's a test. And it's a training session also. Like, I mean, you did it. You know, that's a hard session.
Oh.
But the other way you do it.
I mean, you genuinely feel, I mean, just for those of you who haven't done an FTP test, there is some discussion. Maybe you can even answer this as we digress slightly. But it is mentally very taxing. I was really kind of scared going into it. And your first sort of 10 minutes, you feel, well, I want to blow up any minute. The weird thing is, my son, who's a reasonably good cyclist, said to me, Dad, you should be able to maintain 300 watts. So I went into this test thinking that 300 watts was possible and soon realized that wasn't going to be possible. Then I dropped down to 250 and I was determined to hold on to 250 for that 20 minutes. I just started to dip under that in the last 5 minutes. But mentally, it was absolutely one of the toughest things I've ever done, because you literally know that halfway through that, you're thinking, I don't know whether I'm going to keep going for 20 minutes like this. But you do somehow. I don't know how that works. So there's some schools of thought that suggest that the ramp test that they do is a slightly better way of doing it, because it takes out that mental pressure.
So a couple of things. First of all, if you started your FTP 20, your 20-minute time trial at 300, and you ended at 247, then I'll give the listeners an example of applying the concepts we've spoken about. Next time you do it, you could probably go 270 and you won't blow up, because that 260, 270 is probably actually your level. But when you were at 300, you were so far above your critical power. You were eating into that battery so much.
Well, let me give you I didn't start it at 300. I did actually, in the Zwift test, what they do is they give you a couple of warm-up sessions and they push you into 300. And I realized quite soon that when they started the test, 300 was not going to be very likely. Bali. So I did start and I started trying to maintain 250 right from the beginning.
Because it is,
and I was close to that.
Yeah, okay. Well, that's good. So you actually managed your effort.
My governor motor was working.
So it's about spending your budget, right? And in order to get from the start of the month to the end of the month under budget, you can't blow money in the first week.
Yeah.
And for physiological terms, here's another analogy coming your way for the highlights wheel. Physiology terms is the same thing. But how do we know we're blowing our budget? Is because we're at a power output above FTP or CP.
Right.
And the budget is the W prime, right? So there, instead of a battery, think of it as a budget.
Yeah.
And so to give people an idea, like when pacing goes wrong, it's because people are into their battery. They're eating into that battery or their budget too early. And then they reach a point with like halfway to go. I mean, like I'm only 50% of the way and I'm thinking, crikey, I'm actually pretty close to depleted here. And you're not depleted so much as accumulated of, you know, hydrogen ions and body temperature and heat and all these kind of things that cause fatigue. So that's another way it plays out. Now, the ramp test you're talking about measures a slightly different thing. I don't know the Zwift ramp test, but generally when a sports scientist does a ramp test, we want to test your maximum capabilities. So we want to make you go faster and faster and faster until you crack. And the point at which you break is the point of interest, because that's going to give us a VO2 max if we're measuring oxygen, or it's going to give us a maximum power output. That's not a great way to manage a training program because, and I remember this is again a running example. We used to do these studies when I was at university still as a student, where we would get guys to come on and we were trying to work out whether maximum peak running speed predicted 10K times. And it does. It's a pretty good predictor, like it's 80% predictive. Right. But if you take a guy who's a, and I don't know why they did this, it wasn't me, but they used to test squash players. Now, a squash player is not a 10K runner. But when you do a ramp test with him, if you don't get the ramp test just right, he does unbelievably well because he's so used to like a 5 minute super hard effort that he actually performs quite well, disproportionately well on a ramp test. And then you make him run at 70% of that peak treadmill speed for 40 minutes and he is dead in 20. He cannot do it because he's anchored himself too high. Makes sense, right?
Yeah.
So with ramp tests, you've got to be quite careful because if you're going to prescribe training based on a ceiling, a maximum ceiling, the concrete ceiling, then that could lead to kind of problems. Mm. That's why FTP, and this now, I said, now I'm finally answering your question about how else. So we've already said you use it as a test to diagnose whether you're adapting to training.
Right.
The other way to do it is you use it as an anchor to prescribe training intensities because the FTP represents a ceiling also, but it's a glass ceiling. Mm-hmm. It's not the concrete ceiling that you smash up against. It's the glass one. And sometimes you train above that ceiling. Sometimes you train below it because As a important predictor of performance, it becomes a very useful anchor point to try and guide the prescription of training that will either drive a physiological change above threshold. So now we're talking about neuromuscular, glycolytic adaptations. Because if your FTP is 250 and you're going to ride at 280 for 3 or 4 minute intervals, you're teaching your body how to deal with the glycolytic stress of exercise. So lactate clearance and tolerance, the anaerobic, quote unquote, or impacts of exercise, the hydrogen ion, acidosis, all that kind of stuff, right? That's what you're training. And now you know it because you knew the anchor point at which it started to happen. So now I can go 10% harder than that. Does that make sense,
yeah.
right?
Yeah.
On the other hand, I can use it as a ceiling that I want to stay below because now I know that if I stay below FTP, I'm going to train the oxidative systems. So if I wanted the capillary benefits, the cardiovascular, the lungs, the mitochondrial, and if I want a training stress that is not large enough to cause maybe overtraining, premature fatigue, because, and this is where I come back. You remember you asked about the sweet spot.
Yeah.
You can't be at the sweet spot all the time because it's just too hard.
Yeah.
By definition, I mean, you just said you did that FTP and like you get butterflies just thinking about the next time you got to do it because it's crappy hard. Right?
Yeah.
It's hell of a time.
Crappy hard is a good word.
Yeah.
That is.
And so if you trained at that point all the time, imagine how exhausted and how likely to be injured, overtrained, burned out, hormonally, you'd be wrecked.
Yeah.
So now you use FTP to say, actually, you know what? If that's zone 3 or four, depends on how many zones you want there to be. My easy rides are zone one.
Yeah.
And if my FTP was 250, my easy rides are going to be 60% of my FTP. So that's 150.
Yeah.
And so now you've got a target to aim for. And yeah. and again, you might not have power output if you're not on your smart trainer on Zwift, but now you can use heart rate as a function of that. I mean, heart rate's got its own problems. It's affected by weather and wind and terrain and mood and fatigue and training status and all this kind of stuff. So you've got to be pretty astute and have your ducks in a row. Right. But it's a way that you can use your FTP measured on Zwift to now try and inform you for outdoors. Because what's your heart rate at FTP?
Yeah.
Now that's your anchor point. But the point is that you're using a more reliable, more valid measure of performance to prescribe training intensities that are then going to cause for you different adaptations.
Right.
And then, again, like we spoke in our perfect training one, you probably don't want more than 10 to 20% of your training to be above LT. And the big mistake a lot of people make, by the way, is that they do spend too much time at or just above it.
Yeah.
And I mean, I do that because I like the intensity.
Yeah.
It's actually, like even today, we went riding and you get to a climb that you know is about 5-10 minutes long. You're going to sit on that climb at FTP, more or less. We did. I think we did today.
Yeah. I was slightly over.
Yeah. Because this is why we ride. We feel alive, you know, because it hurts a little bit, but not too much.
Yes.
That's what semi-steady state is.
Yes.
But it's still hard. Eh? Like you couldn't do it all the time.
No.
And most people make that mistake. They train at their so-called sweet spot or threshold or functional threshold, power, CP, because they think that's going to make them the best. But actually, what you want to do is polarize your training so that you do a lot more at low intensities, because you still get the same benefits that are going to affect CP and FTP. Right. Remember those mitochondria, the capillaries, the enzymes, the fat oxidation ability. You're still stressing those systems at lower power outputs than FTP. And then you spend 10% of your time above FTP, because that's where you're learning lactate tolerance and really dealing with the glycolytic side effects of exercise. So polarize the training in order to shift the middle. That's the great irony, is you don't have to train the middle to shift the middle.
Yeah. So just here's a couple of quick questions. One of them is a theory. For most of people listening to this podcast, they might have a smart trainer. I would guess that probably most don't. Most people probably won't ride with a power meter. Most people will just have a normal bike. If I did find out my FTP getting onto Zwift, or I managed to go to a gym and sort that kind of thing out, would it be feasible, if you had a heart rate monitor, which is a much more easily accessible method of measuring things, to go and do a test at my suggested 1 hour, my FTP, in other words, my 1 hour time, measure my average heart rate in that time, and then realize that my heart rate was in that zone, so that I could work my heart rate within those zones if it was only a heart rate monitor that I had? In other words, if I knew what my 1 hour average heart rate was, is that a good measure of my power? And taking one step further, is that how it would be useful for runners?
Yes. Yeah, so that's one way to do it. The other way is RPE, but we'll get to that in a moment. Yeah. So for heart rate, if you started out and your heart rate's 120 on the start line and you're going to ride for an hour maximally, so that by the 61-minute mark you're falling off the bicycle or running, okay, 60-minute max run is – That's
what I would do. What I would do is I would do my FTP test like I've done.
The 20-minute one.
And then say, okay, it's 237 or whatever it is. And then go ride 237 for an hour and work out what my average heart rate was.
So not a bad approximation. You might want to look at that heart rate trace and see what it looks like. Because if it reaches a steady state, for instance, in the last 10 minutes, that's a better measure, the last 10 minutes compared to the whole thing. Because otherwise it's sucked down by the fact that you start at a low heart rate. And then your heart rate is going to go up and then maybe steady out. Probably won't get steady state though, because a 20-minute one, you're probably just going to go up and up and up and up. You will
fatigue.
Yeah. So then you've got to be quite smart about which heart rate do you use. Is it the last 10 minutes? Because now you're probably overestimating it.
Yeah.
Is it the whole thing? So you might have to play around a little bit on that. There are studies and relationships between lactate threshold, power output, RPE, where people have made these tables that relate one to the other. So like, for instance, they'll say that your zone one is 60% or 50% of FTP. The RPE is going to be 2 and your heart rate is going to be 65% of your age-derived max using the Carvenan equation or something like that. So there are ways to equate one to the other that already exist. So I'll give you an example of that, actually, because I've seen it in a paper. So
because I'm talking specifically about the runners out there who don't, you know, you can't measure power in running. So the only way you can measure running for the average person is to wear a heart rate monitor and you'll look at your speed.
Right, and or RPE, right? So for instance, I'll give you an example here. Like, so this is Coggan again, who we mentioned earlier, and he's done all this stuff with Training Peaks that many listeners may know of. So he has a 7-zone system. So let's say zone 2 here is the endurance zone. He's talking here about going at 70, between 56 and 75% of your LT power. That's your lactate threshold power. Let's call it FTP. Average heart rate will be between 70 and 80%, and the RPE will be 2 to 3.
Right.
So that's more or less right. When we get to, but this average heart rate, by the way, is percentage of the LT heart rate. So it's the metric that you mentioned using. In other words, I'm going to go and measure my heart rate for that 20-minute effort, and then use that as my LT heart rate, or my functional threshold heart rate.
It would be your average heart rate for that 20 minutes.
Right, in this instance. And so he's saying, yeah, it's like level 4 is his LT zone. So you've got 7 levels, the middle one is LT. So again, you're in the middle here. And the average power would be between 90 and 105% of LT power. The average heart rate will be between 95 and 105% LT power, which makes sense. Because
where can we find that?
This is a chapter of the book that he wrote, on training with power, which I found just through a Google search because it came up in a couple of scientific papers.
So what are we Googling?
Coggan training with power chapter. So it's pretty good. I mean, it's well written, and he knows his onions, obviously, you know. And then the perceived exertion, see, and this is, I don't agree with this, is perceived exertion for the LT power is 4 to 5. And I mean, you're not at 4 to 5. So
no,
I think maybe
too low.
Maybe Coggan and I have different ideas of what perceived exertion is. For me, that's not 4 to 5. I mean, I'm at 7, 8 in the beginning. And by the end, I'm at 10, you know, because anyway, perceived exertion is quite complex. For me, if I didn't have a heart rate monitor or a power monitor, I'm biased because my PhD was on perceived exertion. So I think it's a very good way to judge training. But obviously, I appreciate some people.
It feels kind of a bit unscientific, I always think, with RPE. But
yeah, no, I've often joked, like, they gave me a PhD for asking people how they feel. You know, it's a stupid concept.
Should be a psychologist.
Yeah. But it's actually quite complex because that perception of effort is integrating everything going on in your body, including emotional stuff, like that you can't even think to measure.
Right.
But it's psychology, emotion, context, environment, mood, temperature, sodium levels, hydrogen levels, glycogen levels, whatever, like oxygen levels, carbon dioxide levels, you name it.
If you could measure RPE with some sort of wrist device, it would probably be the ultimate way of measuring something, but that's impossible.
Yeah, like
it?
If you can measure, you could turn brain activity into a number.
Yeah.
You use it like a fuel gauge in a car does with a volume of mass.
Yeah.
So RPE for me is always going to be the best thing. So if your RPE in that 20-minute effort, let's say, you see, because RPE is going to be affected so much by just the pain that you induce or impose on your body over the course of the 20 minutes that it becomes actually like skewed by sensation. It's more like a rating of perceived sensation, not output. And this is where it gets tricky. So when Coggan talks about an RPE of 4 or 5, he's talking about output exertion.
Right.
Like as in, I could apply twice the force, but I'm not. I'm applying half the force I could, therefore it's a 5. When I'm going maximally, like a 20-second sprint, now I'm a 10.
Right.
But the 20-second sprint doesn't hurt as much as the 20 minutes at 5.
No.
So depending on how you understand RPE, this is probably a subject for another discussion.
Yeah, for sure.
But it actually changes. I remember we once played around with a rating of mechanical work to try and distinguish the sensation part from the actual output part. You know, so like, if I didn't let you see your power, even today on the ride, I said, what do you think you're at? And you were like 250, which means that you've got some idea of what the work of 250 feels like.
Yes.
And that's because you're feeling it through your legs. You're feeling it as a resistance and as a sort of sensation of pain mechanically, you know? But at that point in time, that didn't feel like an RPE of 10 to you, but it might have corresponded to an exertion of 7.
It was uncomfortably hard.
Yeah. But so had you gone at that intensity for another 10 minutes, Your RPE would have been 10, but your work exertion would have still been the same. So anyway, let me not muddy these waters with a different concept to what we're talking about. I still think, though, that most runners, if they are listening to their bodies and not deceiving themselves, could use RPE and nothing else to train smartly. The Kenyan athletes do that. They don't have all the gadgets that we do. And they just listen. So they know that on an easy run, I'm a 2 out of 10 at the start and I'm a 4 out of 10 at the finish. And if someone said to me, can you do this again? I'd say, sure, because it was easy.
Right.
It's a 4. When they do their harder work, then they know that this is a 5 becoming a 6 or a 7. And when they do their track sessions, they know that this is going to be a 9.
Yeah.
And they're pretty well dialed in, you know. And the same thing with cyclists. So I think with experience, athletes probably learn RPE in a way that, in my opinion, probably trumps all these other metrics. But the best combination, I reckon, is if you're aware of your perception of efforts and your RP and how you're recovering and all that sort of stuff, and then you contextualize it with data, which is the journey you're on now. So now you're looking at the data, you're checking, okay, today I did Strava and I did the following, blah, blah, blah. So next time I do it, I'm going to feel like this. So you're actually constantly learning to relate RPE to heart rate, to power and time and stopwatch. And that's the beauty of the training.
I'm actually
going
to go into my Strava now and look at what my power, potential power was at the time that I said, I think I'm doing 250, because I wasn't sure I needed a heart rate monitor, but it will hopefully give me a measure of that based on the course.
I think it was. We looked at that earlier. It was that Glastonbury climb where I think it was like 240 odd and then 260 odd. So it's pretty much exactly.
I think just to wrap up the discussion today, I think the magic of what we talk about with these things, and you and I agree on this, is that, and one of the reasons why you got involved in sports science at a very early age, and why I think to some extent my fascination by this has driven some of the motivation around my training, is that the more we know, the more motivating it is. Whether our numbers are low or high, we start looking at our performance based on our own performance. Like I've stopped looking and basing myself around how good somebody else is. But I can go for a ride with you today and a ride with somebody else tomorrow, and I can say, am I riding within my own limits and pushing where I can? Am I improving? And I think what FTP does is it gives you, as you've sort of said on a number of occasions, it gives you the opportunity to kind of see where you're at. And looking at the numbers kind of gives us a distraction. It gives us a goal. It gives us something to be interested in. And I think that for those of you who are involved in cycling and running and triathlon, any kind of endurance sports, even swimming, as we've already discussed, it's a tool to allow you to better your performance, but also a tool that kind of gives you more enjoyment around your sport, because you have something to base your training on. And I think when I think about this thing, yes, it's science. Yes, it's interesting. Yes, it's a great number to look at. But most importantly, it's quite fun to understand what this all means.
I'm with you. Like, not everyone's like that. I mean, there are some people who look at this and go like, I don't want to see numbers. Like, I'm just going to go ride for 2 hours. It might be 2.5. It might be 1.5. I don't really care. I just want to be outside and enjoy myself. And then there are other people who are like obsessive about the data, actually to a fault, where they become so anal about every single thing that they actually can't vary it. And then I do wonder, how do they enjoy it? But they do, because that's actually the thing about it, that, you know, it's the sport gives them a way to produce numbers, and they love the numbers. So I agree with you. I mean, when I was a school kid, I remember getting a heart rate monitor, Polar Vantage, something with NV.
I remember it,
And downloading it every day on my crappy computer at home and making an Excel chart, building a table, plotting some graphs. It was trivial, basic stuff, you know, 15, 16 years old. But a big part of the run was actually the opportunity to make the data.
Yeah.
And then as you become more intelligent about it, and this is the key thing, is you start asking better questions. So you start saying, why did I get dropped by my mates up that climb but not that one?
Yeah.
Okay, well, the first climb was a really steep one for 5 minutes. The second one was a really long one for 25 minutes, but it wasn't quite as steep.
Yeah.
And so maybe there's something about my physiology that's not so good for short efforts.
Yeah.
But now I've got an anchor point, because I can now understand critical power. I understand like that it might predict my W prime. And maybe over the next month, I'm actually going to work on that element of my cycling.
Yeah.
So I'm going to do some hard intervals, 45-second, 2-minute intervals, whatever it is. And a month from now, I'm not going to be dropped on that short, steep climb. Yeah. Sure enough, you do it. What a cool project. So that's the value of all this discussion. I mean, I know it's technical. And again, if you've stuck it out and you're a rugby fan or whatever, like the principles are no different for swimming, for cycling, for triathlon, for team sports. They're no different. You just have to understand, like, why does the performance drop? Why do we suffer? Why does fatigue occur? And then work backwards from there to like change it when that happens, if at all. So hopefully that's clarified for people and it's not muddied the waters. And I've tried as much as possible, we both have, to not use language without explaining what we're actually talking about.
I'm still not sure I understand the sentence that you said to me, but I certainly have more clarity.
As a principle, you do. So that's, you may not yet know MCT ones and fours
the
and
acronyms,
some, but like you now get that lactate's going from one place to the next. And that's, little bits of knowledge. You just acquire them, you apply them, and you learn. And that makes you a better athlete. And hopefully that's the outcome from this chat.
Well, Professor Rostocker, thank you very much for your time today. I know we've basically spent the whole day today. We've been for a ride and we're doing our podcast, and it has been a big learning curve for me. And I hope that for all of you listening, that this issue around FTP, that kind of these muddy waters have been a bit clearer now, and you kind of know a little bit about what it's about and how to work it and how to use it. But until next time, it's goodbye from us.
Follow the Science of Sport podcast at Sports SciPod and on Instagram at Science of Sport Podcast.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.